Welcome, everyone. My name is Ilan Haimov, partner and department head of the Profit Participation Group at GHJ. I would like to welcome you to our next movie business podcast series, where we try and make sense of the new motion picture ecosystem with special guest Peter Deckham. Alongside me today is Jason Squire, professor at the USC School of Cinematic Arts and editor of the movie business book. Jason will go ahead and introduce Peter, and then we'll get our questions started. Jason.
Thank you, Ilan. Welcome back, Peter. Peter Deckham has been listed in Forbes among the top 100 lawyers in the country, and in Premier Magazine is one of the 50 most powerful people in Hollywood. Clients have included George Lucas, Keenan Ivory Wayans, John Travolta, Ron Howard, Rob Reiner, among many others. Peter is the author of Next, Reinventing Media Marketing and Entertainment. His strategic consulting and trend analysis helps entertainment entities cope with change. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you.
So let's jump in. Following the wonderful podcast with you as guest in 2020, let's be optimistic. Post-pandemic, where is the entertainment industry heading? Consolidation, acquisitions, and what about survival of theaters?
Well, first of all, we're focusing here on what we used to call the motion picture and television industry. And we're not talking about music or live stage or sports. We're focusing on that. And obviously, the emphasis here is looking at the melding of the television, which we call streaming. You have audio, video on demand, subscription video on demand, free video on demand. You've got premium video on demand, all these words coming out. But what you're watching is basically a major transition, a financial pressure point on the exhibition world, which not only addresses their own cash flow and sustainability issues, but also consumer viewing habits. Let's take a look at the industry before this pandemic. 40,000 screens in the United States, compare that to like 75,000 screens in China. Probably even before the pandemic, we weren't able to sustain and fill the seat capacity for more than 25,000 screens. For those of you who remember going to the movie theaters, it may require a deep dive into your ancient memory, but you will remember that you go to a movie theater and you'll look at that a popular motion picture will be playing on multiple screens. And you're also noting that during the week, a lot of those screens are empty, and there were attempts to do a little more elastic pricing, but it didn't really work very well. It was pretty clear that the exhibition process was also very expensive. The average production cost for major studio fare, which literally accounted for 90% of the screen time, was somewhere north of $200 million in average. The MPAA no longer reports those numbers because they terrify everybody. And the cost of marketing a motion picture, opening and et cetera, in the United States and Canada was more on the order of magnitude of $50 to $80 million, although most people tell you, well, they're really spending 30. No, they were really spending 50 to 80, and I've seen as much as 100. So you're looking at these movies, some of which have combined production and releasing costs prior to the point of time of the pandemic that were close to $750 million. And that's absurd. So we start with the fact that we were overpricing ourselves, and then the pandemic hits. Not only were there lockdowns, but there was generic fear in the hearts and minds of people who could get to theaters. Well, maybe it's not a good idea to crawl into a room with a bunch of other people for a couple of hours and breathe. Yes, theaters probably have better ventilation and more movement. Yes, you can space people around in the theater. They don't have to sit shoulder to shoulder. But part of the question that you have to ask is, what's in it for me to go to a theater? And that's a really interesting basic question. People go to a theater because, oh, the screen is even bigger than the one I've got at home. It's got even better sound than I've got at home. And I spent $5,000 in my sound system at home, but it's still kind of cool going to a movie theater and have the smell of popcorn and all the other stuff. By the way, popcorn and all that, those concession stands account for somewhere around 25 to 30% of the gross revenues of the relevant theater. Not not a small amount of money. I mean, popcorn doesn't cost a lot and the soda doesn't cost a lot. So it's a high profit margin. So as you were looking now, you're sitting, the thought of going to a theater is becoming abhorrent. There's another giant pattern going on. Retail malls were already failing in record numbers around the United States. Appended to a lot of those retail malls are multiplex cinemas. And as the malls shut down or as the traffic volume within the malls depleted, this is before the pandemic, people were going to the movies less. And those movie theaters are appended to malls that are being shut down, as opposed to the destination malls you might have in urban areas like Los Angeles, where we've got destination malls now. But for most of the United States, those retail malls are not doing that well. And obviously online shopping has had a big impact on it. So we had a movie open up here simultaneously on HBO Max and in theaters. It was called Little Things. It starred Denzel Washington and Rami Malek. It cost about $30 million, which is a very inexpensive motion picture. And it opened on 2,171 screens. Woohoo! It generated $4.8 million from that opening weekend, which was considered to be the number one motion picture in the United States. Pre-pandemic, $4.8 million is an utter unmitigated disaster. You know, if you're not opening at 25, 30, 40 million bucks the opening weekend, that's a good solid opening. If you're opening at 10 or 11, it's okay. But 4.8 is a disaster. That was the number one movie in the United States. Following weekend, 2.8 million. Still a disaster. The total amount of money generated by Little Things was 7.8 million in the US and Canada box office, 5.3 million overseas for a total of 13.1 million. Well, obviously it's also gonna be on HBO Max's streaming service. We'll talk about those kinds of things later, but obviously you are looking at a very interesting reconfiguration. As movies move off of the big screen into a streaming universe as an original release, what you're losing is a massive amount of revenue that would justify spending hundreds of millions of dollars in production and releasing costs. If you have to make a big movie and it does require more money to get it successful, if you take away the theatrical window, that may no longer be possible. Not only that, as we'll talk when we get back into the discussion on Warner Brothers toward the end of this presentation, you've got a big, big set of questions of whether or not after this pandemic, and we don't even know when it's going to end, because notwithstanding the vaccinations, there are new strains of the South African and the Brazilian strain, which appear to be resistant to some of the vaccines. AstraZeneca, for example, does not work on the South African strain, or works much, much less. So we're not really sure if consumers are going to be comfortable going back to theaters and when, or if they've actually broken the habit of going to movie theaters at all. And oddly enough, the people who go to movie theaters the most on a routine, hey, it's Saturday, let's go to the movies, are people over 50. And their kids hooked up their big screens to Netflix and Disney Plus and Warner Max and all the other stuff. So these older folks like me tend to sit home and watch those things and are no longer in the habit of let's go to the movies, it's the weekend. That just doesn't seem to be there. And for the younger demographics, we're talking the X, Y, and younger, they basically go to movies that are must-sees within their influencer peer group scenario. And those have to be events. Finally, think about why you go to movie theaters, which is something I raised a second ago. In addition to the big screen, there's a shared social experience that doesn't necessarily attach to every kind of motion picture. Hard comedies, people like to laugh together. Horror films, people like to shriek and get scared together. Kiddie films for young children, they love to sit there and make squealy noises and be with their friends and watch movies and spill popcorn everywhere. Faith-based and patriotic as ways of showing your friends that you believe in whatever the motion picture is on the screen, and you're uniting in a shared experience. Outside of that, the movies that generate the big bucks tend to be those that are pre-sold on some basis, i.e. they're based on a best-selling novel, they're based on some major historical event. There's this notion that the audience already knows about this content and are prepared to see it. As we move forward, And we start seeing that there are really solid creative choices that are made available on streaming services. You look at certain genres that are almost disappearing unless they're based on some very, very built-in audience want to see specific. And those genres are dramas and action movies. Science fiction is doing a little bit better because the big screen does show up those things. But if you take a look at shows like The Mandalorian and virtual production, which we're seeing a lot of, the capacity to generate much more visually enhanced imagery on the small screen has never been better. So you're beginning to take a look and say, well, dramas are doing really well on Netflix. They might, but they're not doing really well on the big screen unless they're based on bestsellers. So we have to basically live with the fact that we live in an entirely different world and we really don't know where it's going to be. I also understand theaters without people going to it have severe problems on a cash flow basis. AMC wound up raising an additional $506 million in equity and $411 million in debt. A lot of the theater owners are facing bankruptcies. They have landlords. Some of them own their lands. They have all kinds of costs they have to maintain. And what's going to happen? And what happens if a theater goes bankrupt? If you are owed money by that theater, you might just lose it. This could be an exceptionally difficult thing for people in out there in civilian land to take consideration. If you have a bankrupt theater, you don't get any money. And how many of these theaters are chains actually face genuine bankruptcy? If you're overscreened and you have a challenging financial event, what happens? The final observation I'll make in this area is a theater has a limited value. Unlike an office building, which can be converted, you can, if you have one set of tenants, you can pre-rent it. A motion picture multiplex does not automatically convert into anything else that you can use. You can't pre-rent it. You can't, you know, use this theater for another purpose. It doesn't make good office space, doesn't make for good retail space. So you have a single purpose structure with limited value in any other arena facing financial chaos and consumer habit changes. Will theaters continue in the future? Absolutely. Will they be the same cornerstone of motion picture and television financing and upside? I doubt it.
Thank you, Peter. That was very insightful. I'm going to switch gears and talk about the production side and the challenges of the production side, particularly as it relates to insurance coverage and other regulatory and legislation related matters. What we're seeing a lot of productions, while they're still occurring, the cost is rising, obviously in connection with health, safety, and other measures that are best practices right now to ensure safety for the crew. What we're trying to figure out is how is the insurance industry dealing with liability insurance with production now that we're in this pandemic, and with the new administration coming in place, will there potentially be any guarantees that we may see from the government itself in connection with production?
This is a mess. All the major guilds and unions have what we call, you know, COVID protocols. Most governments, state, local, county, provincial, have their requirements, which are often very, very intimately related to the guild requirements. And just from a pragmatic basis, you have a very difficult scenario when your key cast member gets COVID and you have to shut down the production, or worse, your key cast member passes away. We watched Tyler Perry in Georgia shoot a production under a complete bubble. In other words, everybody on that production from actors to crew lived in converted military barracks on his massive production facility out in the Atlanta area. And they stayed there the whole time. Their dinners were catered to their rooms. When they went outside to do anything, to watch movies, they had these giant bubble chairs spaced very far apart to watch movies outdoors. And they had very, very severe restrictions as vendors entered the scene to bring food and other supplies in. Everybody lived in that. The production finished. There were no COVID. Even Tyler lived on that production facility. there were no COVID cases at all, and everything went very well. And somebody asked him, how do you get a crew not to stay home with their families? And this kind of shows the wonderful side of Tyler Perry and adds a little bit of strange humor to it. Tyler said, well, I give a lot of people who have been in prison a second chance, and I hire them to work on my crews, and they're used to it. So I started laughing at that. And I started saying, wait a minute, how are we going to continue where if you're a program supplier, and I represent a lot of companies that are fairly small, so that in the event a production were completely shut down, if they didn't get coverage from somewhere, this could engender bankruptcy. So let's look at what is actually available and how it's applied. First of all, in terms of government subsidies, for the most part, Australia, UK and Canada and France and Austria seem to have programs that provide limited assistance in the event that a production is shut down by reason of COVID. I have to tell you, number one, these programs where they exist, for example, in the UK, they have a £500 million fund, which is $676 million is the whole fund. And you're pretty much capped at £5 million, you know, six million plus something in dollars for, that's your ceiling of what the government subsidy would be like. And if the subsidy cap runs out, there is no additional money. And there are lots of restrictions on what you get, how you apply, et cetera. For example, in the UK scenario, if you are totally shut down, you can get up to 70% of the budget capped at that £5 million. If you are just postponed, you can get up to 20% of the budget, again, capped at that, you know, £5 million. That's a pretty typical scenario in all of these things. You don't have unlimited coverage. I'm going to pull up on my own screen here a list of private insurance. This is a pretty typical scenario. It's hideously expensive. The caps are very unreasonable. And the deductibles are massive. Generally speaking, what you do is you pay 10% of what you, you know, it's a little bit more in some cases, seldom less, but it's around approximately 10% of the coverage that you're seeking. So if you want, you know, a $6 million coverage, assuming it's even available, and it is, I've seen one, you have to put up $600,000. And it's basically, there's a deductible, not always, some have no deductible, but most do have a deductible. But how the deductible is calculated is very interesting. Generally speaking, where there is a deductible, they call it a waiting period. The waiting period effectively means how many production days they will pay for, that or that will not pay for, that you eat. So if it's a 48-hour waiting period, what basically that means, you have two production days, and if you're averaging $150,000 a day in production costs, that pretty much caps, that's a deductible of $300,000. That's a huge deductible. And they have different deductibles depending on which, you know, it may be CAS, there's no deductible. Maybe there's civil authorities and imminent peril reimbursement, there is a deductible. But generally speaking, CAS gets two-thirds of the ceiling. And on average, I've not seen a policy in excess of $6 million of total risk. The more likely ones are in the $2 to $3 million capped range. And if you think about it, what you're talking about when these things shut down, the cost of shutdown, the cost of holding the sets, the locations, and the cast in place, and the cost of restarting. Those are the additional supplemental costs. Now, if you're building a film or television production, and there's a single star that is essential to the production, and that star passes, you now have a complete write-off. And I'm negotiating now with a network. I'm trying to resurrect the old cancellation negotiations that took place back in the old days of network television, because the network broadcasters always had the right to cancel. And then you would negotiate what they call a cancellation fee, which would cover your hard costs plus contractual obligations you couldn't avoid. I'm trying to build that into going forward agreements. Most studios just cover it themselves. They just say, well, you know, Jurassic Park shut down twice. That must have cost a pretty penny. Netflix tends to cover their own internal productions, and larger companies tend to do that. But for individual producers, independents, program suppliers who are only delivering a finished product, those become very serious financial questions. And there is nothing that, you know, you've seen parts of legislation in terms of COVID, you know, stimulus packages or recovery packages. But the reality is it isn't focused on fixing productions and bringing people back to work. So it is a roiling sea of questions. And obviously, if you're shooting someplace where they have better controls, for example, British Columbia has a much lower COVID rate than other parts of Eastern Canada. Israel is theoretically getting it under control. Australia's got it seriously under control. New Zealand has it seriously under control. But now you've got the quarantine issue. You now have, if someone's traveling the United States, the first question is, will they even let you into the country? Are they going to require vaccinations to get into the country? And then what is the quarantine when you arrive? Are you allowed to go to work immediately? If you go to places like Australia, you are taken off the aircraft by a military bus, and you're taken to the hotel of their choice, where you will spend the next, depending on, you know, how you tested, anywhere from 5 to 14 days, getting the food they decide they want to feed you, unless you get someone to prepare for this and you can do it. You know, can pick a hotel and pay a lot more money, et cetera. But for the most part, people don't even know what they're getting into when they get off the plane in Australia. And then you go in and you're finished, you're retested, you're tested all the time. The United States doesn't test very much. And are airlines going to start instituting policies of mandatory testing, mandatory vaccination? Obviously, airlines don't want to do that. It reduces the number of people who are going to get on board. But there's a lot of fear for people getting onto these craft. So all these things are adding to costs. Those protocols, those COVID protocols, are generally adding 5 to 15% to the budgets of the productions.
Wow. Peter, this is such a clear and thorough analysis. Thank you so much. Let's shift gears over to smashing windows. And how can WarnerMedia pay out multi-million dollar settlements? It's $10 million reported to Patty Jenkins, $20 million to Denzel Washington, to allow for release of their entire 2021 slate on HBO Max the same day as theaters. Will that change once all this is over?
Well, you know, when you really take a look at this stuff, let's look at AT&T, which is the parent company. They really started off with 2019, early 2020, with alarming debt. They got $190 billion of corporate debt on their books. It's just like a GDP of a country. They managed to retire some of that debt. But currently, I believe there's somewhere around $164 billion of remaining debt, half of which has to be retired or refinanced within the next five years. So you've got a very interesting scenario. You have a company that absolutely needs money to be able to pay off debt. You know, it has probably about eight point something billion dollars of free cash flow every year. You're looking at, let's just look at the charges they had. AT&T's fourth quarter expenses, including charges of approximately $780 million for the impairment of production and other content delivery at WarnerMedia, with $520 million resulting from the continued shutdown of theaters during the pandemic and the hybrid distribution, that's where you open theatrically and on the streaming services, for their entire 2021 slate. They also have highlighted a non-cash impairment charge of $15.5 billion resulting from changes in our management strategy and our evaluation of domestic video business, i.e., all bets are off. We're writing everything we can off. We're deducting everything. And it's fascinating to ask yourself, like, okay, how did this decision to take 21 motion pictures, their hot theatrical release date, Wonder Woman, you know, all the good stuff, and basically do a hybrid release on big screens and on the small screen? And let's take a look at the fact that HBO Max had about 8 to 9 million subscribers before they made that decision. After they made that decision, HBO Max claims they have 17.2 million activated subscribers. So big increase. There's money coming in from those additional players, even though at this juncture, they're still giving discounted rates to sign up with HBO Max. Together today, HBO and HBO Max reach approximately 40 million people. So we start with that premise. Now we're basically saying to the world, well, I just took my theatrical slate. I cannibalize it for the benefit of my streaming service, HBO Max, because I want people to sign up. And I'm now writing checks to key talent that are really, their agents and their principals are remarkably annoyed that I've taken away the potential of the theatrical release, which was going to make them rich. A few have first dollar growth, but for the most part, they have very favorable upside definitions, which are rendered almost impossible to achieve without a theatrical release. So now you're taking that product without getting their consent, and you're trying to negotiate that after the fact. Okay, great. You write the checks, because otherwise you're not going to get them to come back. Not everybody's going to get happy because you're only paying the really big participants. And what happens when looking at all those subscribers? Remember, HBO grew firmly and phenomenally because of a little teeny TV series called Game of Thrones, where the budgets were between 10 and 20 million an episode. That's pretty substantial. And then it was over and people started canceling. You have some harsh realities out there. If we don't get back to a full theatrical release of a motion picture, we can't replicate the cash flow necessary to compensate overpaid directors, actors, and producers, et cetera. It just doesn't happen. So now what do you do? Also, when you've actually run out of premium motion pictures to bolster the subscriptions to HBO Max, what do they cancel? And you look at HBO Max and HBO with 40 million subscribers, and now compare it to Netflix, which just, I think right now there are 205 million Netflix subscribers, of which 70 million are in the United States. Disney Plus has got 94 million as of the last day or two. And you're looking at Warner Brothers basically in a situation where once this runs out, people are going to start canceling. So there are now rumors all over the place that somehow Warner may have to aggregate with another big supplier like Peacock, Comcast. There's talk about, will Comcast wind up either creating a joint venture with Warner Brothers or actually buying it out? What about CBS All Access Paramount? There are a number of other companies that need to sort of combine, and they might not. But statistically, the average American consumer is willing to pay for 2.5 paid services. Amazon is free if you shop on Amazon Prime, so you get that. So now you have two other services. And if you just look at the numbers, statistically, you're more likely to have Disney Plus and Netflix, and every other family picks something else. Do they pick Hulu? Do they pick up Discovery Plus? At what point does the price so high the consumers won't pay it? And you realize if you've got a 4K streaming service, you got to pay for enhanced bandwidth, and that can cost $100 a month without even looking at the cost of content. So we've got some very interesting pricing structures. And a lot of people, if you're about to be evicted from your home or you have to pay retroactive rent, what's the first thing you're going to cut? I'll end with that. Happy thought. I hear bodies falling down. Are there people slashing wrists?
You've done a great analysis of the issue. I really, really appreciate it. In closing, I wanted to thank you for spending the time with me and Jason, really going deep into these three areas that we've gone through on this podcast. And again, I wanted to thank you, Jason, for partnering with me on doing these podcasts. And I wanted to thank the audience for joining us. Thank you all.